Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, click on that Here We Still Stand banner or go to the Here We Still Stand section of the website and register for the virtual conference. The whole conference is virtual. There's no other kind of conference for you to go to as far as Here We Still Stand is concerned this year. So you need to sign up so you can get that email where you will be provided a link so you can join. It's free. It's free. We're not charging you anything for it. No, nothing is being charged to you. You get to attend, watch all the sessions. The schedule is up on the site, so if you want to see what it looks like for those 2 days, it's pretty jam-packed. We'll be doing a lot of stuff. Sign up. We'd like to hang out with you. Also, I mean, if you haven't done it, I'm sure everyone has done it at this point, but we got to mention it again just because maybe you forgot. If you haven't pre-ordered Unveiling Mercy, Chad Bird's new devotional using the Hebrew language, you got to do it. You got to get in there and order that. Seems like the response has been good, Chad.
I've been very impressed. Yeah. Pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. Getting a lot of traction.
The first day was a killer day. You know, Amazon breaks it down in different categories. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not books, but it's like general categories, very specific categories. So it was a number one new release in like Hebrew Bible, Old Testament Bible studies, Old Testament devotions, and then Christian devotionals, which is a pretty big category.
That
so,
is a big
yeah, category. I was very, very surprised and very, very happy about that that rollout.
Yeah, well, if you haven't ordered it yet, guys, don't be left out. I mean, everyone's doing it. You gotta get the book. So I'll put a link in the show notes so you can pre-order it. That comes out in early November.
Yeah, November 10th is the release date for it.
Yeah, so you're just about a month away, so you might as well pre-order it now. In fact, you should probably just pre-order a couple copies now so that your Christmas presents are taken care of, as I've said. I mean, I know this is true. I mean, I have got some connections at 1517 Publishing, as you might understand, but I'm still ordering copies. I'm going to order copies for gifts this year. And not because I'm trying to, you know, sell some books for Chad, but because I actually believe that the people I'm buying these for are gonna enjoy it and make use of it. So, yep, Unveiling Mercy, check it out. All right, Chad, we left Saul sleeping on Samuel's roof, and we are now. I know I sort of said that last week that the time had come for a king. Well, really, the time had come to meet the king, or who was going to be the king. Now we're gonna get ourselves a king.
Yeah, it's kind of a long drawn out process. When you look at chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12, it's really kind of a 4-chapter process.
Yeah.
You know, in 9 is where you meet Saul and he runs into Samuel by divine appointment. You got that going on. And then we're about to get to the anointing and it's a public choice. But then still later on in chapter 12, you have an even more public affair after Saul has accomplished this great victory. So yeah, it's a long drawn out process, and each chapter has a little bit different perspective to tell us about the king. So yeah, chapter 9 is pretty long, 27 verses long. And we meet Saul, we figure out who he is, find out what he looks like. He's the big guy, you know, he's the rock. And we find out how he has this interaction with Samuel. And we left off with verse 25, where he's gonna sleep. He's going to spend the night on the roof of the house here in the town that he ended up in, where he met Samuel. So we're going to find out what happens the next day. So we'll pick up here at verse 26. It says, they got up early in the morning, and about daybreak, Samuel called to Saul on the roof, saying, get up that I may send you away. So Saul gets up, and he and Samuel go out into the street. And they're working their way to the edge of the city, it says, verse 27, when Samuel tells Saul to basically send his servant on ahead, because he's got this, you know, he's going to have a private conversation. No one is going to be privy to this conversation except Samuel and Saul. He's about to, as he says here, proclaim the word of God to him. And I suspect by this point, Saul has a pretty good idea of what this word of God is going to be, because he's had some pretty heavy hints dropped by Samuel. And not just the hints, but I mean, he's also, he's put him at the head of the table. He's given him a special cut of meat. And he's suggested that he is the one on whom the hopes of Israel hang. So if Saul's got to be pretty dim-witted by this point, not to realize that something big is about to go down. So that takes us to the end of chapter 9. It's kind of a strange chapter break, as we've seen multiple times. But anyway, chapter 10 is going to pick up right there where Samuel and Saul are standing together on the outskirts of the city, and Samuel is about to finally do the deed. He's going to take out his flask of oil and anoint him as king. So if you're, I don't know how most people listen. I'm assuming most people just listen to this, but I know a few people actually follow along in their Bibles. So depending on what translation you're using, you've either got like an average length verse or you've got a really long verse. So I'm going to read to you what I have in New American Standard. It says, "Then Samuel took the flask of oil and poured it on his head," that is, poured it on Saul's head, "kissed him and said, 'Has not the Lord anointed you a ruler over his inheritance?'" Okay, that's all I got. Now, if you're following along in something like the ESV and probably some other translations as well, it's got a lot more to it. It says, you know, the first part's the same. Samuel takes the flask, he pours it on his head, he kisses him. Says, "Has not the Lord anointed you to be prince over his people?" But then it goes on, "And you shall," this is the extra material, "and you shall reign over the people of the Lord, and you will save them from the hand of their surrounding enemies. And this shall be the sign to you that the Lord has anointed you to be prince over his heritage." So depending on which translation you're looking at, some of these are going to be twice as long as the one that I initially read to you. And the reason is that in the Greek translation, which is called the Septuagint, we have a much longer version than we have in the Hebrew. So we talk about the Septuagint on occasion. Let me just real briefly, for those of you who might not be familiar with it, tell you exactly what the Septuagint or the Greek translation is. So it's called the Septuagint. Sometimes you'll see it abbreviated as LXX, which are the Roman numerals for 70. So the name Septuagint and, of course, those Roman numerals point us to a tradition connected with 70. Well, why 70? Well, here's the story. This is recorded in an ancient document called the Letter of Aristeus. And here's what the tradition is described in that letter. It says that during the reign of Ptolemy II Philadelphus, who started his reign, I think, in 285 BC. So we're looking at the 3rd century BC. And during that particular reign, Ptolemy wanted some books to be added to the library there in Alexandria, Egypt. And one of the books he wanted added was the Hebrew scriptures. So what they did, according to this tradition, is they sent to Israel and they brought back 70 scholars of the Torah. Some later traditions say it was 72, but 70. They brought those back from Israel to Alexandria in Egypt. And they, according to the tradition, they separated them. And each one had like their own little room or something. And then they were each given a copy of the Torah, just the first five books. And they translated the Hebrew of the Torah into Greek. And then when they came back together, after their work was all done, lo and behold, every single one of them had the exact same translation, even though they all worked independently. That was thus seen as an attestation of God's imprimatur upon this particular translation, which, yeah, I mean, if the tradition were true, that would certainly stand to reason. So that is where the origins of the 70, the book of the 70, or the Septuagint come from. Now, there's a couple things to keep in mind about that. First of all, that was only, according to this tradition, that was only the Torah that was translated, okay? So what about the other books? Well, over time, over a lot of time, probably over the next couple of centuries, the other books of the Hebrew Bible were translated by different people with different abilities at different times. And so you have a lot of a lot of differences of translation style, a lot of differences in translation quality among all the other books after the Torah. Most people agree that the Septuagint translation of the Torah, the Pentateuch, is pretty good. It's pretty accurate. Once you get past that, some are better than others. Now, why is all this important? Well, it's important because, for one reason, when you get to the New Testament, most of the time when New Testament authors will quote an Old Testament text, their quotation is from, the majority of times, it's from the Septuagint. Because that was kind of like, you know, in the 1800s, which translation did everybody use? Which English translation did everybody use? Of course, everybody used the King James Version, right? That was just what everybody used. Well, in the first century, among Greek-speaking Jews, everybody used the Septuagint. That was just a commonly accepted translation.
Greek is the most common language in the modern world at that time. That this is the language that it's sort of a, like, you can go to tons of different places and like they speak English, even if it's not the primary language, but everyone learns it because it's such a prevalent language all over the world. Greek is sort of that way, right? Where it's like if you were gonna learn one language
in the first century
outside of the language, outside of your native tongue, surely it's Greek.
Yeah, surely it's Greek. Exactly. Yeah, and that's what had happened. You know, you read about the Jewish diaspora, which was the spreading of Jews all over the Roman Empire. Well, they're a long way from the motherland, and what happened is when they were that far separated, well, they began to basically adopt a lot of the customs of the people they lived around. They were living in Greek cities or later Roman cities. And of course, they just learned Greek. And I'm sure many of them learned Latin as well, but they learned Greek. And pretty soon what happened was you had Greek being the liturgy of the synagogue, as well as the reading of the scriptures would have been done in Greek as well in some of these synagogues that were in the far-flung parts of the Roman Empire, including Alexandria, Egypt. So that's kind of a long explanation with regard to this verse, but I wanted to put that out there because we don't always talk about the background of the Septuagint, even though we mentioned it on occasion, but that's it. So all of that to say that when you compare what we now have in our Hebrew Bibles with what's found in the Septuagint, sometimes you will find differences. Sometimes you will find these longer versions, which probably at one point reflected a longer version of the Hebrew that the Septuagint was translating. So if you're usually with modern Bibles, it'll footnote that. Mine actually does not. I don't know if the ESV has that footnoted, that the longer part of it comes from the Septuagint, but that is the reason. Okay. So anyway, back to the story itself. What's significant here is, as far as the actions, is that this is the first time that anybody gets anointed besides a priest. So we've had anointed priest in the past, but this is the first time that somebody gets anointed, not just to be a king, but any non-priest gets anointed. Usually there was an anointing of the high priest, perhaps the other priest. This was the way in which they were designated as God's chosen representative before him and before the people. Now, it's going to be expanded outward. And so Saul is anointed, he's kissed, and he is proclaimed to be the Lord's Messiah with a small case M, Messiah just meaning anointed. So he's anointed to be the Nagid, which is like the prince slash ruler, the guy in charge, we might say, over God's inheritance.
This is kind of a crazy thing if you put yourself in Saul's position. It's not like Saul is like a career politician or something. This would be a crazy 24 hours for you. If you just like just some guy, just like you're king,
looking for your donkeys.
Yeah, you're king now. I mean, it'd be like, I don't know, maybe it's not the same as like president, but like, I don't know, Chad, if all of a sudden someone just showed, if you were like out doing something and then someone said, guess what? You're the governor of Texas going forward. You'd be like, what?
I'd be with Saul. I'd be hiding behind the baggage if that was the case. Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, all this happens within a 2-day period, right? More or less. He shows up and he has this conversation with Samuel, and the next day he gets up and Samuel says, hey, you know what? You're going to be the ruler. You're the guy. So let's talk about a sudden change of life for Saul. And then as if to, I guess, to confirm, to make sure that Saul has confirmation of the fact that he is indeed the Lord's anointed, that God has chosen him, he's given several signs that follow this. And there's three of these in all. So Samuel says to him, here's what's going to happen. So you're going to leave. And when you get close to Rachel's tomb, which is in the territory of Benjamin, these two guys are going to come up. And they're going to tell you that those donkeys that you were looking for, they have been found. And now your dad is no longer worried about the donkeys. He's worried about you. So that's the first sign that Saul's going to have. And then goes on, verse 3, it says you're going to go on a little bit further. You're going to come as far as the oak of Tabor, and you're going to see three guys. Notice there's a progression. He goes from the one guy, Samuel, to the two guys that he meets at Rachel's tomb, to the three guys that he's going to meet going up to God at Bethel. And then the next one's going to be a whole band of prophets. So there's a gradual escalation in number as well. But these three men are going to be going up to God at Bethel. So they're going up to worship at Bethel. And they're going to be carrying three baby goats. One's going to be carrying three baby goats. I would like to see that. I was reading this. I was thinking, I don't really know how that works. I've never tried to carry two baby goats, but three's got to be a real challenge. Anyway,
maybe they're really, really baby goats. Like
maybe so. Like maybe real, he's got them tied up.
Like real small goats.
Yeah, maybe, must be. But anyway, it's going to be hard to miss. I mean, if you meet a guy carrying three baby goats, it's be pretty obvious. And another one's going to be carrying three loaves of bread. And another one is going to carry a jug of wine. So they got the bread, they got the goats, they got the wine. And they're going to greet you, Samuel says, and they're going to give you two loaves of bread, which you will accept from their hand. Now, why is this important? Well, it's important because think about this. These three guys have got the goats, which are presumably going to be a sacrifice. They've got the bread, which is going to be probably given over to the priest. And they've got the wine, which will probably be offered as well. This is probably going to be some sort of communal sacrifice, like the peace offerings, where they're going to give part of that to the priest. And then the priest will give part of it back to them. And they're going to have a communal meal. So they're carrying all of this stuff to worship Yahweh. But what do they do with some of the food? They give two loaves of bread to Saul. Now, why is that important? Because he just has been declared the Lord's anointed, and I mentioned that was only in the past applied to priests. Now, in the second sign, he's going to be given priestly food. He's been given these two loaves of bread, which ordinarily would be given to the priest. So this is a subtle way of indicating that the kingly office, even though it is not a priestly office, is also intimately bound up with the priestly office. So, you know, we have our separation of powers in the American form of democracy, which is fine. We understand that. But we should not apply that to kind of a separation of powers in Israel. It's not the way it worked. It wasn't like you had your priestly branch, then you had your regal branch, and you had your prophetic branch, and all these three had to kind of cooperate. Not the way it happened. In fact, the prophets, the prophetic authority was really over the king's authority. I mean, how many times do the prophets tell the kings what to do and what not to do? In fact, that's exactly what's happening here in the case of Samuel and Saul. So the kings were not, as it were, some sort of independent power, nor were they working together in some sort of democratic way with the priest and the prophets. No, it was like basically the prophet was over the kings as well as the priest, calling them to account. And the king had a sacred office. And you could say that the priest had a sort of regal office as well. I mean, they were dressed like they were kings. So there was I don't know what the word would be, sort of a symbiosis, this real intimate connection between the priestly and the kingly office. At least ideally, that was the way it was supposed to happen. So that's the significance of him receiving this bread, which was for the priest, now given to Saul. And he says, you are to accept it. So that's the second sign. The next one is they're going to get to this place called Gibeath Elohim, which means the hill of God. There's a Philistine garrison there. You know, the Philistines controlled a lot of the territory. This was probably just a place where they stationed troops to make sure that the locals were not going to rebel, I'm assuming. So they got a Philistine garrison there. And Samuel says that when you get to the city, now this is where things get strange. There's going to be a group of prophets coming down from the high place, and they got all these instruments. They got harps, tambourines, flutes, and a lyre. And presumably they're playing all these instruments, and they will be prophesying. Then it goes on to say that the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you mightily, and you shall prophesy with them and be changed into another man. We'll come back to that, but let me just finish out this section. Samuel goes on to say that when these signs come to you, do for yourself what the occasion requires, because God is with you. And then he wraps it up by saying, you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and I will come to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You're to wait 7 days until I come to you and show you what you should do. Now, I'll be completely honest with you. I do not know what to make of the prophesying and the musical instruments. I mean, I've studied this. I had a graduate class on prophets. We looked at this back then. I've read books on prophets. I've read the commentaries on 1 Samuel, and this stuff still throws me for a loop, because I think part of the reason is, first of all, this doesn't match what we usually think about when we think of prophets, right? When we think prophets, we think Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. And yes, they have visions and they do strange things, but pretty much what they do is they preach. Prophets are preachers. These guys are more like sort of, I don't know, they're what, musicians and singers of some sort. They've got the musical instruments, you know, they've got their harps and tambourines and flutes and lyres, and they're prophesying. What does it mean they're prophesying?
It's a prophetic jam band.
There's something
real Grateful Dead about this whole thing, like where it's like, and these hippies are going to come down from the hills, and
yeah,
you know, this is a real Lord of the Rings kind of stuff going on here. But the mm-hmm. you always want to surround yourself with people that at least every once in a while are like, I don't know. Yeah. That's what you want. No, like we had this happen in 30 minutes in the New Testament. We were going through 1 Corinthians, and Paul's talking about head coverings and stuff, and he's making the argument, you know, and he says, you know, because of the angels.
right.
And he just throws it
out there like, you know, everybody, because of the angels.
Yeah, and Eric and I had to be straight with people, like, no idea what he's talking about. Like, no, Paul, I don't know, because of the angels. I have no idea what that has to do with anything. And I know, when you read commentaries, and at some point you're like, I feel like this is all speculation and conjecture. And you're like, I think this one's lost on me. I think I had to have been there for this.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, I will tell you, most people explain this that this kind of prophesying is you slip into some sort of like ecstatic kind of trance-like state, I suppose, and you're prophesying. But even to me, that's speculative too, because it doesn't say that.
Right.
I mean, it does say you'll be changed into another man, but there's different ways that we can take that. That doesn't mean like all of a sudden you're gonna be saying and doing all sorts of really weird stuff, like you're high on something. And in that way, you're going to be changed into another man. It doesn't necessarily mean that.
The idea that the Spirit would come and change you into another man is not something that we can't wrap our heads around. Obviously, there's a new man. We know about that. We know about this, right?
Happens all the time. Sure.
Yeah, all the time. This doesn't mean Now, no one standing next to you is going to say, that guy used to be this man, and now he's this man. It would be, obviously, we're not taking it that literally. But, you know, I mean, obviously, Samuel is no doubt implying that you weren't a king before, and you're going to be a king now. Well, that's a different sort of man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a difference between a guy looking for donkeys and a king. Like, those aren't the same guy, usually.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it just struck me in this conversation. You know, this is another fascinating angle to this. I've already mentioned that there's this connection between the kingly office and the priestly office. Well, lo and behold, look, now that we have another connection, because here we have a guy who is just chosen as king and who's going to receive priestly bread. And then the next thing you know, what's he going to be doing? He's going to be hanging out prophesying with prophets.
Yeah.
So he really does in some sort of way have aspects of all three of these callings, of these divine callings. I mean, he's going to be a king for sure, but he also is going to have a prophetic aspect to his vocation. He's going to have a priestly aspect to his vocation. So we're used to kind of separating these three out, but there's an element of a combination of these in the leader of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's not stretching the language too far to say that Saul is going to walk away from this a different person. I mean, we understand how this kind of language works,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, someone experiences something and like they say, oh, that they were completely different after that. They were, you know, someone goes to war and you say they came back mm-hmm. a different person, or they got married. I've said this about one of my younger brothers. Like, man, after he got married, like, he was a completely different person in a positive way, by the way,
mm-hmm.
It was an improvement, but we know what that kind of language is like, where, and this is going, I mean, can you think of a more radical change than this? Like, you're going to walk away from this whole deal, a very different man than you walked in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, we can speculate back and forth as to exactly what's going on here with the musicians and the prophesying, but that is no doubt the message that is intended to be conveyed. All of this is happening to Saul because, yeah, I mean, he's starting out in a calling that nothing could have prepared him for. So he really does need to be going through these highly charged, highly emotional, highly transformative experiences, because that is the only thing that's going to ready him for what's coming up. So anyway, this is what happens. It says that, Samuel goes on to say, you know, all these things are going to happen. And then in 7 days, I'm going to meet you at Gilgal. So that takes us through verse 8. Now here's what happened afterward. It says that after all these things were spoken, when Saul turned his back to leave Samuel, God changed his heart. And all those signs came about on that day. I was interested because I wonder if that's the same Hebrew verb that's used. It is. So if you look in verse 6 where it says, become another man or be changed into another man, and then verse 9 where God changed his heart, same word, same verb. It usually means overturn, but it can be, you know, it can be used in the sense of change. So God is, maybe we could say he flipped him over. He turned him around to be a different kind of person. So it wasn't just that the experience of these things changed him, rather God himself was the one who was behind this, and he was changing Saul to ready him for what was to take place. Now, in the section that follows this, which is 10 through 16, there's no recording of the first of those two signs happening. There's no recording of the two guys that meet him and say, hey, where you been? You know, we found the donkeys. Your dad is really worried about you. There's no recording of that, nor is there a recording of the three guys with the wine and the bread and the goats. We just assume, of course, that happened. But what is recorded is when Saul meets the prophets. So it says they came to the hill, and a group of prophets met him, and the Spirit of God came upon him mightily so that he prophesied among them. So this was just in fulfillment of what Samuel had said. And here's the reaction of the people. It says that all who knew Saul previously saw how he prophesied now with the prophets. And the people said to one another, understandably, they said, what's happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets? And there was one guy who said, now who is their father? Therefore, it became a proverb, is Saul also among the prophets? When he finished prophesying, he came to the high place, is the way that section wraps up. Now, this too has been taken a lot of different ways. Like when it says it became a proverb, is Saul also among the prophets? Usually, proverbs are pretty straightforward and pretty clear. This one is not so much so. What does it mean? How is it proverbial to say, is Saul also among the prophets? I mean, you could take it to mean is that this guy is acting completely contrary to everything that we associate with him, right? So you see a guy and he's like from the last time you saw him to now, he's either a completely different person in a bad way or a good way. And so you might say to your buddy, is Saul also among the prophets? Meaning, you know, is what's up with this guy? He's a different person. One commentator I read, this was actually attractive to me. He read this whole story as if to say that Saul is now no longer really so much the son of Kish as he is the adopted son of Samuel. So when they say, what has happened to the son of Kish, they're implying by that he doesn't really seem to be Kish's son anymore. In fact, he seems to be acting like Samuel, who is the father of the prophets. So I find that particularly attractive. I don't know that we can necessarily say one is correct and one is not. But at least my reaction from their words is to say that because Saul is acting in a way that seems very un-Saul-like, people are astounded. And because of this, they make up this proverb to kind of encapsulate what it means for someone to become a different person than what they were before.
Yeah, it almost seems like it becomes a saying that you could apply to anybody who is doing something that seems contrary to what they would normally do, right? So
yeah,
in the New Testament, when they roll out, can anything good come from Nazareth? This is a saying that he didn't just make it up. It's like a saying, and they're like, hey, there's this dude from Nazareth, and they just say it, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, you had another guy that had some guy that never built something ever in his whole life, and all of a sudden, like, he goes and builds a house. You might say, it's all among the prophets.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We need to resurrect this proverb. Yeah.
We do.
We need to just start. We'll just like throw it in randomly in the next few narratives that we cover where something unexpected happens. Whew. Is Saul also among the prophets?
Yeah, that's probably what they said when David struck Goliath. They were like, is Saul among the prophets right now?
right. So anyway, the three signs, yeah, they were all fulfilled. The first two were just not mentioned, but this third one, that's what happened when he met the prophets. Then he gets home. And we have another kind of strange exchange here. So this is 14 through 16. He gets home and Saul's uncle says to him, and to his servant, where'd you go? Presumably, like, dude, you've been gone days.
Yeah.
Like, where were you? Where did you go? And he said, I went to look for the donkeys. And when we saw they couldn't be found, we went to Samuel. And then that was probably not the good answer, because that just piqued Saul's uncle's interest. He's like, oh, yeah, well, tell me what Samuel said to you. And this is all Saul told him. He said, oh, he told us plainly that the donkeys had been found.
Yeah, that's what he said. That's all he said.
That's
it.
That's all he said. Well, it's not a lie. I mean, it's certainly not the whole truth, but it's not a lie. He did tell him, hey, the donkeys have been found. And then it clarifies. It says he did not tell him about the matter of the kingdom, which Samuel had mentioned. Yeah, that's pretty obvious. He decided he would hold back on that particular bit of information.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think, Saul's got to be in this situation like, oh, he told me I was going to be king.
Yeah. Like, that's, he knew his uncle would laugh.
That's not, how are you going to tell somebody that?
Yeah.
Like, you really need Samuel to tell somebody that.
Yeah. You can imagine if Saul's like recounting, well, here's what happened. You know, I met Samuel. He told me I was going to be a king. And then all this other stuff went down and his uncle would be looking at him like, kid, there's no way all this happened.
He'd probably say to him, were you hanging out with those prophets on that mountain?
Right, right.
With the mushrooms. What are you talking about?
Yeah. So anyway, we don't know why, by the way, we don't know why this is Saul's uncle. The guy I mentioned earlier who thought that Samuel had adopted Saul as his son thinks this was actually Saul's dad, but because he had been, as it were, adopted now, that he's called his uncle.
Hmm.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that's one of those, it sounds good. You can't necessarily prove it. it sounds good. I don't think there's any reason really to understand this as anybody but his uncle. You know, maybe his dad's doing something else that day, and so only his uncle's home. Anyway, that takes us through the middle of the chapter. So let's figure out what happens next. We're coming up to a big event here. So verse 17, Samuel called everybody together at Mizpah, which is ironic because if you remember the end of Judges chapter 20, the last time that Israel gathered at Mizpah, not the last time, but when they gathered at Mizpah in Judges 20, it was to go destroy the people of Gibeah, where there had been the horrendous rape scene. So now they're gathering at Mizpah for a very different reason. So he gathers them at Mizpah and he addresses them. Now this address is not positive. This is not like, glad you're all here because God's got a gift for you.
Yeah.
This is a very different kind of sermon. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought Israel up from Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the power of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But anytime there's like that lead and then it says, but it's like, oh, this is not going to, what follows this is not going to be good.
Here's what you don't want. Like there's two buts. Okay. There's two buts. And the but that you don't want is God saying something good, then but. That's never good. The but that you like is when God says, you're a rebellious, horrible, treacherous, idolatrous people, but. And you're like, okay, good. Like, okay, good. This one is, it's all about whether the positive or the negative comes first. And if the positive comes first, followed by a but, this is not good.
Yeah, that's a very good paradigm by which to interpret all sorts of things like this. So yeah, the first part is great. Yeah, I did all this for you, but all right. Well, what follows the but? But you today rejected your God. Wow, you rejected your God who delivers you from all your calamities and your distresses. Yet you have said no, but set a king over us. Now, therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans. So God did all this, but here's what you did. And this takes us back to the chapter where we had Samuel basically trying to talk the people out of getting a king, right? They said, set a king over us because, number one, we want to be like all the nations. And number two, your sons are not like you are, Samuel. I mean, you're a good guy. You've done great things for Israel. But here's the problem. Your sons are corrupt and they're not fit to rule over us. So we want a king. And of course, Samuel goes through all of the things the king is going to take from them. He's going to take your crops. He's going to take your sons. He's going to take your daughters. He's going to take all these things from you. But the people steadfastly refused to change their mind. So what does he do? Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near. And they cast lots, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. And then he brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its families, and they cast lots. And the Matrite family was taken by lot. And Saul, the son of, they cast lots, you know, for all the individual members of that family. And Saul, the son of Kish, was taken. And the next line you would expect would be, and Saul stood up, right? And he was ready to be king, but that's not what happens. It says, when they looked for him, he could not be found. So they, you know, started asking around, and then they inquired of the Lord, and they can't even find, that's the funny part, they can't even find him. Like, nobody knows where he is. God's the only one. And so God says, oh, he's hiding himself by the baggage.
This whole thing is fascinating because Samuel knows that this is the guy. He's already told him he's the guy. He's already like anointed him. And then he's like, all right, let's do this Lot's thing. And
yeah,
there's only two explanations. Either Samuel's got this whole thing rigged, or he's just real confident that that's how these lots are going to go.
Yeah, right, right. Now, I know we're at our 40-minute mark, so let me leave you here with a little teaser here. Now, so I'll test your memory, you longtime listeners. If you were with us for quite a while, and you've been with us through, you know, 1 Samuel and Ruth and Judges, and all the way back into Joshua. So go back into Joshua and see if you can remember a time when the tribes were brought forward and lots were cast, and then clans and then families, and then finally the lot fell to a very specific person. So test your memory there and see what you can find in the book of Joshua where that happened, and then compare it with what happens here and see if maybe you can put those two together and come up with an explanation as to how they might fit together. And then we'll unpack that when we come back next week.
Look at this, guys. Teaser. I was about to say something and comment on it, but I can't now. Now yeah, he's left it right
wait.
There. Can't give things. I can't try to give answers here. Guys, thanks for joining us for the podcast today. Make sure you go and register for Here We Still Stand virtual conference. We'd love to hang out with all of you guys. It is in the show notes, as well as the link for the pre-order for Chad's new book, Unveiling Mercy. Make sure you do that as well. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right, we'll see you then.